There are times during surgery when you discover a way to make things easier or more efficient. Sometimes there are through our own quicksand moments. Others are surgical gems gifted to us by our mentors and peers. This is OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Hugh, where we learn how to pivot, reflect, and evolve as surgeons.
Welcome, everyone, to the fifth episode of Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles, Eureka Moments. We're your hosts. I'm Dr. Nicole Fram, and this is Dr. Elizabeth Yu.
Yo, we are so excited to continue with season three. Eureka Moments has been just a lot of fun, lots of different surgical pearls where we focus on great takeaway moments, those coming out of the dark. I mean, we've been able to karaoke from the quicksand cases, and it's just been, it's really been refreshing. Don't you think, Nicole?
Yeah. I mean, Liz, there's always this point in surgery where you just feel like you can't get through it. And then you can think to yourself, you know, who taught me this one surgical pearl or gem, and who is in my ear today? And what we want to do with this podcast is kind of give you guys the gifts that were given to us so that you can skip those steps in the learning curve.
That's absolutely right. And then combined with our own experiences, we can kind of hopefully mitigate those sticky quicksand moments, but it's helped to shape our own techniques, figure out those little nuances that have helped us create those plans A through Z so we can implement and then perform under pressure so that we can get through and take care of what we need to, depending on what each situation actually calls for.
Yeah. So, you know, Liz, I just want to remind everyone that this season will be available through video and audio podcasts. So you can listen on your favorite platform and watch us on YouTube. We are back. At the end of this podcast, we'd love for you to fill out a short survey. I'm not seeing the surveys, Liz. I mean, like, I need some feedback here.
You know,
so please,
right.
Give it to us. We can take it. The good, yeah. The bad, the ugly. We can look in the mirror. Help us understand, you know, what was valuable, what was not so valuable, so that we can integrate that into future episodes.
Like, I want to look at myself in the mirror and say, you know what? I need to improve on this today. Let your feedback help me say that. So, and you know what? All these episodes, we are so lucky for sponsorship because that allows us for this content to be on those different YouTube as well as the different podcast formats. And this time, our sponsor is Tarsus Pharmaceuticals. It applies a very proven science and new technology to help revolutionize treatment for patients in different areas of medicines, starting with eye care with lotilaner 0.25% in the commercially available XDEMVY. Tarsus is advancing its pipeline to address several diseases for unmet needs across a therapeutic multiple of categories, specifically with the infectious disease prevention in mind. Tarsus is proud to announce that XDEMVY, which is lotilaner ophthalmic solution 0.25%, is available to prescribe to help our patients with Demodex blepharitis. And it is the first and only available RX therapeutic in the class for Demodex blepharitis. And it has been such a welcomed addition for this because we know that Demodex blepharitis is upwards of probably 60% of patients, of those patients who are walking into our clinics, and of blepharitis in general, it is the most common form of blepharitis. So it's great that we finally have a non-homeopathic, non-over-the-counter solution. Now, who is our guest today?
Liz, we need to introduce our guest today. We would love to introduce Dr. Nandini Venkateswaran. I think I said that right. So Nandini is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Medical School and a member of the Cornea and Refractive Surgery Service at Massachusetts Eye and Ear. She is fellowship trained in cataract, cornea, and a refractive surgeon. She specializes in cataract surgery with premium lenses, refractive surgery, corneal transplantation, and the most complex anterior segment reconstruction. She completed her ophthalmology residency at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, University of Miami, after which she completed a prestigious fellowship in cornea and external disease and refractive surgery at Duke University. I mean, who doesn't want to be with Terry Kim? She is an active member of ASCRS and is part of the YES committee, as well as helping lead ASCRS virtual grand rounds, which are incredible learning resources for all of us. She has several peer-reviewed publications, even though she still looks like she's in junior high, and she's published multiple book chapters and is an active teacher and lecturer at national meetings. But most of all, she is just pure joy and enthusiasm for our future. So welcome. We're so happy to have you here.
Hello.
Can I just say, Dr. Venkateswaran is such a premier eye surgeon, and it's shocking that Dr. Frim and I have known her since she was basically a resident. And so it's weird to see that Dr. Frim and I are already kind of in the beginning of our last third of our career. Like, we are definitely in the at least middle to, but it's shocking to see there are generations and generations of younger doctors beyond us who are just, they've got meteoric rises, and there are a few that I can think of. And Nandini is definitely the top of, well, one of the top of that list. I don't want to say only, but she is amazing. And I have to say, in that group, very small, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your eureka moments, all of those that you have learned, but you are going to share some pearls that are just so important. And we've just not broached this topic before. So it's just such a joy to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. You're making me blush, but I brought my friend with me.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you to the Tarsus, you know, mite.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tarsus. For sponsoring this.
Great. Yeah. So before we start, I just want to remind everyone, you know, this podcast, this webcast is about how to get out of those difficult moments quickly, skip steps, and make sure that you can find that eureka from either a mentor, someone who you've seen a video of, just someone who's going to be in your mind during surgery to help you get out of quicksand and move to the next step and make a complex case routine. So Nandini, please take it away.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor. And I want to present a case that was certainly very challenging, but I think replete with some eureka moments that I think we can all learn from. So just to give you context, at 10 p.m. on a weeknight, I'm on call for the faculty. And my fellow calls me and he goes, "Hey, I have a patient to run by you." And I was like, "All right, sure, shoot." And he goes, "Well, we have a 66-year-old female. She comes to our ER after an aborted cataract surgery. Sounds like they did the capsulorhexis, attempted to do nuclear disassembly, but then stopped because of significant posterior pressure and iris prolapse. And the surgeon was very concerned about an intraoperative choroidal hemorrhage or effusion." So the patient comes to our clinic in the emergency room, and this is what she looks like. So certainly, you know, something that stuck out to me was I could actually get a view into the eye. The cornea was still clear, but obviously an irregular pupil with significant iris prolapse out of that infrotemporal wound. There's a suture trying to close that area up. There's heme interspersed in the AC, probably from all of the iris manipulation. And the lens material seems like it's largely contained in the lens. I'm not seeing too much in the anterior chamber. Thankfully, our retina colleagues did an ultrasound and there was no choroidal effusion or hemorrhage. And so she was stable from the posterior aspects of the eye. So now we're chatting and in my head, I'm just running through like, you know, what do I do now? And my fellow goes, "Oh yeah, we booked the OR. So what would you like to do?" And I was like, "Well, I guess we're going to the OR." But I wanted to take a step back and just think, because I was like, all right, is this something that I, you know, need to go to the OR for right now? And just kind of taking into account, this is a woman who had surgery in the morning. She's been in our ER for multiple hours undergoing an evaluation. She has an open globe in a sense, right? She has iris out of the eye with an open wound. And I'm fortunate. I have a pristine cornea and a view, and there's no kind of phacoanaphylactic inflammation in the anterior chamber from that lens material that hasn't been removed. So I decided to go ahead and proceed with the case since we had the OR time available. So the first question I have for him is, I go, what lens are we going to put in the eye? And in my head, I'm like, should we turn on a biometer? Should we be measuring the eyes real time? There's no tech coming in at, you know, close to midnight to measure axial length or K values for me. But the surgeon had had the foresight to send her biometry. And so I was glad to see I had an axial length, anterior chamber, white to white K measurements. And what really stuck out to me was that it was a small eye, short axial length, shallow anterior chamber, small horizontal white to white diameter. So definitely risk factors already that I see that could predispose this patient to having, you know, iris prolapse or posterior pressure. So I'm calculating the lens on the side, and I'm also texting my fellow. And this is something that I think all of us really should always do when we have emergent cases or complex cases. Anything you think you need, have it available in the room. And these are little things you don't even think about on a day-to-day when you're doing a phaco during business hours and the team you know knows everything, right? I'm thinking of every medication I need. You know, what do I do pre-op in terms of IV mannitol or IV diamox prep to kind of decompress the vitreous? What sort of block do I need? Do they even know how to set up the phaco tray? Do I have iris expansion devices, viscoelastic blades, spatulas, anterior retractor? So this was just real time, like stuff I was texting my fellow. And I'm like, let's just make sure we go on a treasure hunt and find all of this with the teams that we have it real time available. So let's jump into the case. You'll see that I start off here doing an infranasal conjunctival cut down. I wanted to do a subtenons block because I didn't want to really induce more posterior pressure with the full retrobulbar block, but I wanted the patient to be completely comfortable. I'm opening up that wound that was attempted to be closed, and I'm just taking my time kind of making my initial incisions. The chamber is very shallow, and the iris is already tenting up in an awkward way from that iris prolapse, and I didn't want to induce any further iris damage. As you know, I'm doing this, I have Nicole and Liz in my ear, actually, and I was just thinking, sweep the iris. Do not try to push the iris in from where the tissue is just coming out of the main wound. And I initially tried to do that while simultaneously injecting Helon and sweeping, but then I switched over to a cyclodialysis spatula in a few seconds and really was working to kind of get to the base of that iris tissue and truly sweep it out of the wound. And I think this maneuver is so important because our gut instinct is to just, you know, kind of get at the iris tissue and even just poke it in. But what happens is the more you irritate iris tissue, the more it wants to come out. So I was just really taking my time trying to ensure that I could get that iris tissue completely into the eye. As soon as I got the tissue in the eye, I decided to close the wound so that nothing further would come out and that I ensured that nothing was further incarcerated within that wound. At this point, I noticed that the iris tissue was very irregular and atonic, and I wanted to make sure I improved my visualization to the best that I could. So iris hooks became my friend here, and that was another eureka moment for me. You know, this is not a great scenario to put a Malugin ring or any type of other expansion device, but really kind of targeting areas where you want to move irregular tissue out of the way is key. And with any iris manipulation, you're going to get heme in the AC. And here I was just trying to burp out, you know, the extra blood that had accumulated and used bimanual IA just to kind of irrigate and aspirate the small blood clots that existed as I was manipulating the iris. And in the back of my head, I was already thinking, you know, I'll just inflate the eye with viscoelastic if I need to tamponade the bleeding, but if necessary. But in this scenario, I was actually fortunate that I was able to get all of the hemorrhage out of the anterior chamber. So at this point, I actually switch over to create a new superior wound because I need new real estate to be able to get into the eye and perform the phaco. And I use TriPan and I paint it carefully to really assess my anterior capsule because I don't really know what we have. You know, I was told there was a full rexus, but to my surprise and to my joy, you know, there actually was a full intact capsular rexus, and you can't quite appreciate it on the video, but as I was rinsing out the TriPan, I could really see it quite well. And so once I finished kind of rinsing out the TriPan and really seeing everything, I was ready to, you know, proceed with the phaco. And I'm just kind of taking my time to ensure that I'm doing kind of a safe technique for nucleus disassembly. You know, I'm usually a CHOP surgeon. I'll kind of, you know, quickly disassemble the nucleus in many of my cases. But in a scenario like this, where I'm not sure about the status of the anterior capsule or the status of the posterior capsule, kind of going back to, you know, divide and conquer techniques is really critical, because I think it allows you to have good control and good, you know, mastery of the lens material in the eye. Also, from a phaco setting standpoint, I was really using low flow settings because I didn't want things to come out of the eye. I didn't want to push too much fluid in where things would then want to come out. At this point, you'll kind of see that there's a little area of unruly iris that wants to keep coming out at me. And this is the time for another iris hook. So I was able to kind of use my iris hooks to my advantage again. And I remember my fellow telling me that was a really good idea, because I think a lot of us would have tried to just power through and get the lens out. But I really wanted the best visualization that I could in order to remove the lens nucleus. But essentially at this point, I'm, you know, removing all of the lens material. And one of the key steps that I do as soon as the entire lens is out is inflate the eye before removing my phaco, because I really didn't want any surge or any, you know, movement of the capsular bag in an untoward way where I could cause a posterior capsular tear. We've gotten this far, but I was able to place the one piece in the bag. I basically calculated with an aim of minus 0.5, you know, just to account for any inaccuracies in the measurement, and was able to then finish the case by removing my iris hooks, sealing all of my incisions, and using some Myocol to make sure that the pupil was constricted and circular. And I had this moment here where I was like, should I repair the iris? Because I don't really like seeing that area of atrophic iris. But, you know, at almost 1:30 a.m., it's not the time to maybe add on another complexity to the scenario. And so, you know, less is more sometimes. And so staging a procedure and seeing if and when that's needed, I thought, was the best move at this point. So our patient did very well. I'd like to just go to the next slide and I can show the postoperative photo. And so you can just see here that she at post-op month one looked really great. Pristine cornea, a little bit of posterior synechiae, but that area of the iris defect was asymptomatic to her. She really wasn't bothered by photophobia and she was correcting to 20/20. So we've continued to monitor her. She's had a little bit of recurrent iritis, but she continues to do well and she's in no hurry to touch the cataract in her other eye.
You know, yeah, this is great. All right.
Awesome.
Let's bring the video back up because there's so many things. So yeah. Liz, go.
All right. Go. So this is basically like we are, you know, we're going to talk about this as if this was basically it's iatrogenic, but it is a traumatic cataract case, right? This is like surgical gems on managing a trauma, right? And on top of that, it's a small eye. I mean, yes, we've talked about small eyes before, but can we just stop the video right here? I love, and I think we should talk about anesthesia of choice. I love that you used, and of course, because this is a penetrating trauma, of course, in a small eye, I love that you did the preoperative mannitol. If this was not an open globe, then I would also consider using a Honan balloon to help to decompress. That's like another great surgical pearl. But the IV mannitol preoperatively was beautiful. That gentle, you know, ultrasound to make sure that there was no foreign body, not that this would have been because of the scenario, but making sure that there's nothing that we need to worry about in terms of foreign body, and or certainly seeing, you know, if there was any other, how far that the lens itself has been violated capsule wise is also, you know, something that we need to consider here. But the fact that you did not do a retrobulbar, now, when do you consider, Nicole Nandini, doing subtenons and a small subtenons, especially in a small eye, versus like a non-depolarizing agent in general?
I mean, I would say that, you know, the first thing is the eye hard or is the eye soft, right? So if you have kind of a rupture globe and you don't know what the positive pressure is going to be with a retrobulbar and you already have iris coming out of the wound, that's a hard no in terms of doing a retrobulbar. And I've had it happen where the retina doctor was going in before I was on a combined case and the iris was not stable at the wound there and they popped the iris out with how much they put in. So I love the choice of a subtenons of having proper akinesia for this case. So the other thing about the IV mannitol, just to go back, is that you did a B scan preoperatively. If this patient, may have had a shallow suprachoroidal, and then they waited so long that it flattened back out and the choroid looked a little thickened. So I would just say that if the pressure is really low and you have documented that they have a suprachoroidal or choroidal detachments, you don't want to give mannitol, right? Because then you're lowering the pressure more. So there's just a little subtle point that just because you're getting positive pressure, it doesn't necessarily mean mannitol all the time, right?
True.
It means so, but yes, in this scenario, it was great. The other thing that's right here, it's like pointing right. It's like amazing. The way you angle, this is a eureka moment, everyone. This is so little.
The way but it's you so angled important.
Your para so that you can sweep. Because you angle it perpendicular, you can't get
temporal wound.
You can't get. Can everybody do that?
Yeah.
You can't do it. So anyway, all right, go on, Liz. Go, break it down.
Oh, no. I was just describing it for those who are listening on the podcast, like having, you know, just like, you know, when we do our iris hooks, like I aim towards the pupil, right? Okay. So I'm much more vertical, but I aim towards the pupil in, you know, to, because each pupil size is a little bit different too. So for my iris hooks, I aim towards where the pupil is so that my iris hook can actually capture
more posterior. Yeah.
Exactly. So more posteriorly, but it kind of depends, right? Yeah. Like the size of it. But here she's aiming her para towards her temporal wound exactly to that 2.4-ish millimeter where there's a good amount of iris prolapse, but it's not completely atrophic. And it's about a millimeter of or millimeter half of prolapse iris, but it doesn't look like it's dragged or it's been out or re-epithelialized.
Right.
It's just because sometimes that's a whole nother level of story too.
So this is what I was thinking when I saw this case is that, so just to be clear for the listeners, she aimed her paracentesis to, you know, on a tangential angle at the limbus so that she could sweep the iris more into the eye more easily. I would probably, it depends on how long the iris prolapses out of the eye. If it's obviously epithelialized, you do not put that back in, right? For epithelial downgrowth, but also for endophthalmitis. I don't think that iris, after I started sweeping, would have been very functional and it just ended up getting in your way. I probably would have trimmed some of it, you know, and definitely betadine before you start this case, because even if it's 12 hours, you know, it's 12 hours exposed. So that's the only thing I would have done differently. And then we just come, because then it won't be in your way. You know, the extent of the iris defect. So let's keep going on the video. The next thing about closing this.
Ooh, but one thing
before
plus so duration of the iris being out, I agree in terms of blunt trauma, it just depends, but sometimes cutting it is not necessarily the best thing because that can cause a whole lot of bleeding. If it, you know, and as Dr. Venkateswaran did, if you can bring it in. If it's so floppy that a part of it is just being dragged and stuck, then trim it. Cannot bring in, because as she so elegantly shows, you can do two. I mean, it may cause an iridodialysis,
Oh my God. That happened to you? I was like, don't go. So you went a little bit, you said go to the posterior root of the iris. I would start a little more superficial because
anteriorly. Yeah. Yeah.
Start a little more anterior because I have disinserted half the iris.
Especially when there's a lot of posterior pressure on an eye, but then doing the iris hooks next to it, just like she did, it was beautiful. But the magic is right after she does that. Oh my gosh. It was like music to my ears to see that she was not scared to go and create another wound.
Yes.
Genius.
Yeah. Now I have some pearls about this wound. So there's a really amazing doctor in Beverly Hills who had like the best private practice, Dr. John Hofbauer. And he only sat superiorly. And what he always did was take the cons down a little bit, because you got to be in dirty cornea, right? So in this scenario, I would have wanted you a little bit more posterior, because you're going to, not that it matters in this case, but it, you could induce a little bit more sill being right at the limbus, because what you think is the surgical limbus isn't typically the surgical limbus superiorly. But I think you got away with it in this case. But, you know, if you do have to convert and go superiorly for whatever reason, taking the cons down a little bit and being further into dirty cornea is much better there.
So at Mass Eye, Nandini, when do you decide, because you guys are open 24/7, right? Which is why I'm asking you, when do you decide, because you see so much more trauma than we do, that you would go subtenons, which is going to be a lot quicker, versus doing general anesthesia? Just so, you know, like, what is kind of your decision in your, because you've had a lot of experience with these, like, what, because here you definitely got away with it and their pressure obviously wasn't too bad, because you can see a nice warm chamber, nothing's really coming up at you, and you did all the precautionary measures. Like, how did you know that you could get away with the subtenons? Was it based on the pressure of the eye? Like, what were those factors that made you go down that route versus the general? Because I think that, you know, most open globe, quote unquote, you know, that's a pretty dicey, you've got to have some cojones.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
how do you say, ovaries?
Cojones?
How do you say ovaries?
Oh, gosh.
In Espanol.
I only know los ojos. Only the eyeballs.
I expect a comment on how you say ovaries in Espanol. All right, go on. God,
that's actually a really good point. I think when I met the patient, I just felt like, one, I thought the eye looked very stable. She had a normal intraocular pressure. And she was also like not uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. She was actually a very like reasonable, like well-tolerant person. And I was just like, if I can avoid general, I'd like to in the middle of the night. Yes. That was really where I was coming from in this particular case. And it wasn't like a penetrating trauma where, you know, I'm in unknown territory. I could be encountering all sorts
this
of
stuff.
This was
clean, stable.
This was clean. And I was like, I can do a phaco with the subtenons. Like at the end of the day, even if I like broke bag, I could handle this with subtenons. So that's where I came from. But I definitely didn't want to do a retrobulbar, just as you guys, you know, said so well. Like I just didn't want to bring more out of the eye. I wanted it to be a very controlled environment. And so that's why I chose to do subtenons. I think for many of our open globes, like true trauma, they would do general. Mm-hmm. For sure. This was very atypical, and it came to the cornea service because there was a cataract involved. Like typically our open globes go to our chief resident and they do a fantastic job taking care of these globes. And, you know, I've done them a bunch as a resident, but not so much, you know, in practice anymore. But because of the unique scenario of an open capsule and retained lens material, this became more of kind of the cornea case. But that was my thought process in terms of anesthesia. And, you know, even the patient told me, she was just like, I was so comfortable the whole time. And it was a eureka moment for me, because say I was the one who had started this case. Yeah. I really, you know, I would have still potentially blocked her. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, I may have, you know, in a smaller eye, who knows? Like it just made, it gave me food for thought in terms of being, you know, thoughtful for just routine, like when you're just walking into the OR without a complication, like what kind of anesthesia would you potentially, you know, give this patient, especially in her fellow eye?
Yeah. So here, those are great points. Here you're talking about, right now we're looking at bimanual IA, which is very controlled in this kind of scenario, because you can leave the irrigation in and irrigate either with the other hand or put viscoelastic in on position zero as you come out. It's not just to keep the bag back. It's also because if this is a person that had irrigation misdirection, floppy iris, or a small suprachoroidal that was anterior that no one could see that resolved, this is someone who you don't want pressure fluctuations. And one of our first quicksand was with Ike Ahmed, and he said, filling with BSS in these kind of eyes on the way out is not going to be enough. You know, if it's like a nanophthalmic eye or whatever it is to avoid a suprachoroidal. So I think, you know, the fact that you did bimanual, you can stop and then fill on the way out with viscoelastic is twofold, right? Keeping the eye formed, but also avoiding pressure fluctuations that could lead to unwanted outcomes.
I think even avoiding your main wound, right? We already saw what happened in the iris with the main, 2.4 wound. So I was trying my best not to have that happen again. So any way I could use my paras and have a more controlled anterior chamber was critical for me.
Right. Now, the last question I'm going to ask is, let's say that this was a patient that did have, I've seen this many a times where it is a small kind of controlled, like it's like a limbal wound. It does penetrate anterior capsule. So it's a penetrating injury, but the posterior capsule is okay. So they do have a traumatic cataract. It's fluffy because it happened immediately. So the question is, do you manage the cataract at the time of the penetrating trauma injury, or do you wait? I am wait as long as you can, because you have so much more control, even if it's, and obviously you're going to make sure that their IOP oftentimes is very well controlled. It's not like a horrible scenario. Give it where you can kind of control their inflammation. You can get some measurements and you can get, much better control of the scenario. And then you can do a nice cataract surgery at 2 weeks to week four and just get control of the eye at the time of the trauma. Now, sometimes that's not possible, but if possible, how about you guys? Do you always take care of the lens if there is capsule trauma?
I routinely don't. In the ones that I've seen where there's been, I've actually seen mostly large corneal wounds and then a penetrating trauma to the cataract. But even in a smaller one, I just think your fluidics and your chamber stability are very tenuous. So if I can close that wound and allow for some of that natural fibrosis, where I'm less worried about opening that wound back up when I put in my phaco probe and I have my irrigation, I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable. And like you said, I think I can promise more to the patient in terms of lens calculations and thought process and, just outcome, rather than doing it in a scenario where the eye is hot and angry. How about you, Nicole?
Right.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it depends on how fluffy the cataract is at the time of the injury. I mean, you can also just go in with irrigation aspiration and get as much out as you can, leave them aphakic, especially if it's a young person, and then, finish everything up. But you need that chamber stability to do any lens-based surgery. So I fully agree with that. There's some perioperative things that could be helpful in a case like this. Intracameral washed Kenalog can be both diagnostic and therapeutic. It's really nice. Sometimes I leave them with like a snow globe at the end so that they really get that subtenons. I know Liz and I are doing this routinely in a lot of our cases, subtenons, Kenalog, or dexamethasone. Every diabetic gets, subtenons, Kenalog, or dexamethasone. So those are some perioperative thoughts, because you did say that after you had some iridocapsular adhesions, and in order to kind of, manage that postoperatively, having that boost of steroid, having some Decadron during the case, IV Decadron, 8 milligrams, all those things kind of set you up for success.
Right.
Kind of our uveitic protocol kind of approach.
Right. And like for this patient, like let's say you weren't able to take the cataract, at least if you use dexamethasone as a subtenons, then that's only going to last 7 to 10 days if they have an IOP issue, right? But it is surprising that even if you don't manage the traumatic cataract that is going to form, that you don't manage at the time of the penetrating trauma, folks, just letting you know, it is shocking. Like I would say 50 to 70% of them, the IOP is actually, you don't have like a phacolytic kind of glaucoma reaction that I expected, when I was a resident, but it really doesn't happen. Like it's very under control. It's very controllable with sometimes one or two meds, and you get that capsule to fibrose, you get a much more stable, condition, and you're able to do a much better visual prognosis or give them a much better visual prognosis. But at the time of surgery versus if you were to do Kenalog, and that can last upwards of 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
So that could be more of an IOP issue. So if there's any of that concern, then that dexamethasone gives, just that extra little boost in that short hyper postoperative period.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great. Go ahead.
Just one other thing that came to mind, you know, I mean, just talking about uveitic cataracts or pro-inflammatory scenarios, something I now do for those uveitic cases or even like some of my DMEC cases, I put Lovenox in the infusion. And that actually really helps with fiber formation and, you know, extra intraoperative, you know, inflammation, which, you know, in this particular scenario, probably not necessary, but sometimes in those cases where you're really lysing a lot of Sinicae or tapping on the iris a lot, that's been like a really big eureka moment for me in those scenarios, because really suppresses that inflammation.
And what's your dosing for your Lovenox?
I order it from the pharmacy. I look at it specifically. I think it's like 40 milligrams. It into the bag. And then it just runs through your infusion, and it's been really streamlined. I just have to remember to tell my nurses, don't give it to the patient in pre-op. Yeah. They don't need the Lovenox, but it's quite easy for them to implement.
Dean Iwano is the one that kind of brought this to the main stage. He's a brilliant cornea surgeon. And, you know, I was like, what do you need that for? And you get one DMEC where fibrin's like wrapped around the whole thing and it will never unfold. And you're like, I think I'm going to use this on all my DMECs. So thanks for bringing that up. Sometimes you want clot, right? So if the eye was actively bleeding, you want, you know, don't go after all the little clots in the angle. Cause sometimes, you know, if you get a view and you can keep things, you know, stable in the chamber, sometimes you leave those little clots, even though it doesn't look pretty.
Wow. Right. This was such a great eureka moments case. I mean, thank you so much, Dr. Venkateswaran. Thank you all for listening to this episode of OQC Eureka Moments. We really hope that sharing these different pearls and techniques will help to speed up your learning curve. And for anyone who's taking call and managing open globes, that some of these pearls will help you. So it'll kind of, you know, help you down that decision tree. And we really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is just such an awesome podcast, and I'm just so honored to be here.
And thank you for making the future of ophthalmology so bright. Please remember to email quicksandchronicles@ascrs.org with any questions, feedback, and comments. And don't forget to fill out the survey. And remember, every time you think you have the eyeball figured out, it's going to humble you.
And we hope that these collective experiences will help you, me, all of us develop that grace under pressure. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. Peace.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu. Hindsight really is 2020.